If you're on a GLP-1, you're probably loving the results. You look good. But how do you feel? How about the stomach issues? Loss of muscle mass? Lacking energy? All of those side effects can take a toll. So now what? The answer is GNC. We have solutions that can help address those side effects and make sure you don't get knocked off your path. Because when it comes to living healthy, we're all about it. And that includes keeping you going on your GLP-1 journey. GNC.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Plus, auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Quote now at progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hi, I'm actor and comedian Griffin Newman.
And I'm film critic David Sim.
Together, we host Blank Check, a movie podcast where week by week we overanalyze directors' complete filmographies.
In each new series, we discuss filmmakers who experience early success and are issued a series of blank checks by Hollywood to make their own crazy passion projects.
Now, sometimes those checks clear and sometimes they bounce, baby.
We're joined each week by incredible guests, including actors, writers, and directors. So you can follow Blank Check with Griffin and David on Spotify for new episodes every Sunday.
The year is 2015, and we're going to podcast the f*** out of this. The movie, The Martian.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to
Unspooled.
I am Paul Scheer, joined as always by my friend, movie critic extraordinaire, Amy Nicholson.
Hello.
And we love talking about movies. We're talking about the 2015 film, The Martian. Ridley Scott's, I think in many ways, like a kind of a comeback or a return to form for Ridley Scott in 2015.
After Exodus, Gods and Men, which yes. People did not love. And after his kind of, he was on a gloomy stretch. Prometheus, similar scenes, people getting surgery, but it's real screamy and real miserable, even as they're doing it by themselves in a room. Sorry, Noomi Rapace. That looked real painful. Paul, we picked this movie for kind of a reason, which is soon, not yet, but soon, you will be off doing many, many, many very busy things. And I thought, I'm going to miss you. So I thought we should do a movie or two about being separated and having to survive on our own for a few weeks. Don't worry, guys. We've got great guests planned, but I'm going to miss Paul.
Well, I'm going to miss you. I'm going to be touring Europe with How Did This Get Made for a couple weeks. And I'm bummed to not talk to you about movies. But we also, maybe we need some space because we did have a bet about the Academy Awards. And we're going to see who won. And you know, always after that, there's always a little bit of tension between us, so I think that maybe we need some space to just, accept our winners and losers. And if you want to see who won, you can go to social media, check that out right now. But in talking about a loser, let's talk about The Martian, a movie that was nominated for so many awards and did not win any of them.
One of the big losers of the night, 7 noms, no wins.
And it's a shame because it's one of these films where I think that up against that slate of films of that year, this is the one that probably people remember the most because it was a big old hit. I mean, it was such a big hit that I think people didn't even see this as an Academy Award film. They saw it more as like popcorn entertainment.
It's weird how that happens. You like something so much that then it becomes popular and it doesn't win anything. You know, The Risk of Barbie.
Yeah, and this is a movie that also really tries hard not to fall into any of the traps that many movies where a solo actor is doing all of it. It's not overly emotional. I think that you and I are wrestling with this. I know I was watching the movie. I'm like, but does it have enough? I really enjoyed it, but does it have enough is the question I kind of go back to.
I feel like this is a movie that's really easy to find yourself actually identifying with, you know?
Yes.
I mean, this is a movie where somebody has a boss who just says, oh, that's going to take 6 months. I'll give you 3. This is a movie where you can send a really important dramatic text out into the universe. Like, what did the crew say when they heard I was alive? And NASA leaves Matt Damon on red. Are you receiving ? Oh, it's cold. Oh, it's cold.
I love this movie because it doesn't try to shortcut science. It really shows you how hard it is. And I think that that's why it's so triumphant in the end. There is something about Matt Damon. And I think when you look at these movies with one actor, what is the DNA? Why do we like this person? What's important about this actor in this role? You know, what could he do that maybe Adam Driver can't do, you know, when he's fighting dinosaurs in that movie that no one saw?
Oh, yeah, I didn't even see that. And that's weird.
But also, why do we go to space to tell these stories? Let's stop teasing it and let's get our asses to Mars. Wrong movie, but let's unspool it. The year is 2015, and NASA has just announced something very big.
It says it has new evidence of flowing water on the surface of Mars. This finding, it's a game changer. Now, water raises hope that the cold, dry, so-called red planet may sustain life.
Water on Mars. It is a sign that we might yet find life or seed life on the red planet. And it's a great promotion for a movie that's about to come out in just 4 days. Ridley Scott's The Martian is about an astronaut who gets marooned in space and learns how to grow potatoes and his own shit to survive.
Coincidence? Probably. But NASA is very, very, very into getting the Martian movie off the ground. Their scientists have opened their own pod bay doors to Ridley Scott, who has set out to try to capture the reality of life in outer space. This reality from the man who scared audiences to death with an 8-foot jelly bean headed xenomorph in Alien. And this NASA approved realism that he puts into The Martian is probably why there are a lot of posts on the internet today from people who thought The Martian was based on a true story.
The Martian is actually written by one of my favorites, Drew Goddard, of Cloverfield and Cabin in the Woods fame. It's based on a book by Andy Weir, which actually started as a serial on his like blog site. Matt Damon plays Mark Watney, a botanist stranded on Mars. His former crew feels bad about that. They didn't know he was still there. They're played by Jessica Chastain, Michael Pena, Kate Mara, Sebastian Stan, and Axel Henny. And in NASA, we have a lot more people, but we're going to mix those people with the JPL folks, too. That's right. This cast is stacked. They're trying to bring Mark home, and they are played by Jeff Daniels, Chiwetel Ejiofor, Mackenzie Davis, Benedict Wong, Donald Glover, and Kristen Wiig. As they debate what to do, Mark just gets on with the hard work of living one soul at a time. And souls are Mars days, by the way. They're about 40 minutes longer than our days.
Yeah, so I don't know what day The Martian would have been released on Mars, but here, the calendar day that we used for the day The Martian was released was October 2nd, 2015. And it did great here on Earth. A big box office, 10th highest grossing film of the year, 7 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Adapted Screenplay. It lost all of them. That Oscar's the Best Picture winner was Spotlight, but, you know, so it goes, one soul at a time. So what was in the zeitgeist that October 2nd? A rare thing happened on the Billboard charts. The Weeknd hit number one with The Hills, you know, a very, very horny song about, let's call it, a more immediate quest for human connection. But the interesting thing about that is that The Hills claimed the number one spot by bumping off another number one song from The Weeknd, the song I Can't Feel My Face. So at that moment, that weekend, it kind of felt like The Weeknd was the only artist on the charts. He was alone on planet Billboard, if you are willing to go along with my analogy.
Well, of course, I'm going to have to go along with that analogy because it's perfect, Amy.
By the way, Paul, only 10 other musical stars have ever achieved that rare stratosphere of success before The Weeknd did it, The Weeknd of The Martian. I will give you, Paul, 20 seconds to name as many artists as you think you can.
So artists that had number one. All right, I'm going to just go bold and say Beyonce, Beatles, Barbara Streisand, and I'm looking at like Eminem.
You got one right. You got the Beatles. The other ones are kind of surprising. Ready?
Yeah.
Boyz II Men, Puff Daddy, Ja Rule, Nelly, Outkast, Usher, T.I., Black Eyed Peas, and then the other one that seems kind of inevitable. Taylor Swift.
Oh, right. I should have said Taylor Swift. God damn it.
Wow. So congrats to The Weeknd. You did it, kid. You did it.
You're in a rare air of great artists, actually, too. Amy, I remember when this movie came out. And I mean, of course I do. It just was a couple of years ago. But people went crazy for this movie. It's one of those rare sci-fi films that's fun and light. You don't really need to be into sci-fi to enjoy this sci-fi film. Like, it's very accessible, but I think a hallmark of that accessibility was really epitomized in the fact that the Golden Globes put this in the best comedy or musical category for best film, and Matt Damon also was put in the best comedy or musical performance for best actor. And I thought that was really funny. I remember there was so much hand-wringing about that. You know, just people really upset. But I think there's something about this movie that allows it to be placed in that category. Yes, it's a drama, sure. It's kind of an action movie. It's very popcorn, I think. And unlike other Golden Globe films or even Academy Awards, it kind of brings in this other audience. I was thinking about that while watching it. It's just, I think maybe the battle this film had, the reason why it lost out to everything, because it doesn't feel like this is our important awards film. This feels like a fun movie. Like, what if I was trapped on Mars?
Yeah. I mean, it is funny. It is funny. That kind of tone is something that Ridley Scott loves. Like, one of his quotes on why he makes movies is that he believes that we need to make movies that, as he puts it, because he's British, you want bums in seats. That's what you do. That's my business. Bums in seats. That's not me trying to do a British accent. That's just me trying to sound smart. But this movie is a comedy. This movie is a comedy. This movie isn't hiding that it's a comedy. It's not a serious movie where a couple funny jokes happen. This is a movie where as soon as the scientists on Mars start opening their mouth, they're cracking jokes.
Roger that. Martinez, the captain, would like you to please
shut your smart mouth.
We would prefer to use a different adjective to describe Martinez's mouth.
Oh, did Beck just insult me?
Dr. Beck, and yes.
Like, this isn't a comedy where sometimes we're like, oh, I'm going to call that film a comedy because I smiled wryly as I shed one tear. This is just outright trying to make you laugh.
But it also isn't Armageddon style comedy, right? Like that Michael Bay, like, we don't give a fuck. It's very grounded, right? It's real. You know, there's a whole running joke in the entire film that Mark Watney is like cursing the entire time. Like, he's, what the fuck? What's going on?
Yeah, fuck is literally the first thing he says when he wakes up on this planet by himself.
Fuck.
After he goes through a nightmare of like, I can't breathe. I need surgery. He finally speaks, and that is what the first thing he says.
And I have to say, just, we'll get into it because obviously we have to, but Matt Damon really makes this movie. I feel like you couldn't have cast this part better because I think he himself embodies exactly what we're talking about. Like, it feels like I'm watching What If Matt Damon Got Caught on Mars. He has an everyman nature about him. You buy that he's a botanist. He's not the smartest botanist. He's not the best. He's just a
astronaut. Best botanist on planet Mars.
Well, the best botanist on planet Mars. But you know, the last time something like this happened, not that this actually happened. And by the way, I do love that so many people thought it was based on a true story. We are fucking idiots. But the way that the movie...
Hopefully we'll be on Mars in 2030, you guys. You're really ambitious.
Yes, Andy Weir does say the movie takes place in 2035.
Oh, and NASA says they hope we'll be there in the 2030s at some point.
Well, that's great. And they hopefully will lose somebody probably before 2040.
I wonder if they'll try to like take a mission that leaves on July 7th, 2035. Because like as he wrote the book, the author actually was like, when would be the day that we would be most likely to launch that? When would the orbits be in alignment where it would make sense for us to actually go off to Mars? Because he was really going into the hardcore science of it.
Right.
It would be funny if, as a nod, they picked that day just like he did for the same reasons.
Stranger things have happened. I mean, boy, oh boy, what I love about this movie is really that last monologue that Matt Damon gives in the classroom.
When I was up there, stranded by myself, did I think I was going to die? Yes, absolutely. And that's one you need to know going in because it's going to happen to you. This is space. It does not cooperate. At some point, everything's going to go south on you. Everything's going to go south, and you're going to say, this is it. This is how I end. Now, you can either accept that or you can get to work. You do the math. You solve one problem, then you solve the next one. And then the next. And if you solve enough problems, you get to come home.
And I think this movie is really one for the nerds. Everybody is extremely smart. They are applauded for being smart. They do things well. Things still mess up, but these are rational people making rational decisions based on science and math. And if you told me that that's what this movie was, it would sound super boring, but Ridley Scott has made science and math and smart people incredibly interesting.
Well, yeah. I mean, when he says in that monologue that, you know, this is how you survive space, this is what it's like to be in space, this is what it's like to be in a planet in space, I kept thinking, well, yeah, Earth is also just a planet in space. In some way, we are all just people on some planet in space trying to figure out how to do the best, how to get through this life as best you can. Solve one problem, then you solve the next one. Because I am definitely a person who tries to solve 30 problems in my head at once and has a complete meltdown. To be able to think as orderly as a Mark Watney would be a good thing for me to learn how to do, to figure out how to frame my life in this same kind of speech way. If I could be as orderly and as adamant and as determined as he is, I mean, in a way, this is a movie that's about, you know, not like a physical superhero or like a super suit superhero, not like Iron Man. It's about a guy who's like a mental superhero, a guy who is determination man, you know, calmly, methodically figuring it out.
But not because he is that when the movie starts. He has to be that, right? He is, and I think that you get this from dialogue later on the film, like, they make fun of him. He's the botanist, like the botanist. And, you know, and that's great. And he's doing his thing, but he steps up to the plate. Instead of giving up, he tries to figure out how he can survive.
Yeah. And he doesn't do it immediately, even. He like sits there and like, when he finds out he doesn't have, when he has a huge list of everything that could kill him, and then he's going to also maybe run out of food, he sits there for a while. You watch him and he's like changing hoodies, changing sweaters. Time is passing. And it takes him a minute. But then when he gets up and he's like, I'm not going to die here, he starts. It gives him some time to grieve, but then he also jumps into action.
And he fails. He fails a lot. Like, he's not infallible. He's not smarter. And I think one of the cool things about this movie is time and time again, he gives props to everybody on Earth who is helping him, right? And even if the solutions are silly, like, he's like, everybody on Earth right now is trying to help me with this, you know, moon rover. And the best idea that they come up with is drilling a hole in the top of it and dropping a rock on it. You know, he's acknowledging, like, look, that would have maybe been my idea, but everyone is behind him. Like, he's working with the smartest people. He's not doing it alone. Like, yes, he did some things by himself, but he is not the person who always has a solution. As a matter of fact, this entire movie is about passing the baton. And there's something really inspirational about that.
Yeah. I mean, I know I feel like I say this about 900 characters we talk about in this show, but he, I think, is, he's kind of like if Wile E. Coyote ever succeeded. Like, because the thing about Wile E. Coyote that you have to admire is he's a guy who comes up with plans and maybe they fail, but he also keeps chipping away at it one day at a time.
Yeah.
And even kind of the way he like acts in the movie reminds me of like the ultimate ideal of what Wile E. Coyote could be if it ever went right for him. He even, you know, not only does he like blow himself up and then goes back in and figures it out again, he communicates by holding up signs, you know, like, yes, no, hello, JPL, can you communicate with me? I love that. To me, I feel like when he's holding up the signs, that almost just feels deliberate.
I mean, look, he also, you know, I don't know how many fingers Wile E. Coyote has, but he definitely employs the thumbs up a lot.
When you say you don't know how many fingers Wile E. Coyote has, is that because you think he could have like 7 or 12 or like 4?
Like 3.
3? You think he has 3 fingers?
I mean, let's Google it right now and find out. I don't want to live a day longer not knowing the answer.
I feel like my gut says 4, but it could be 5.
It looks like 3.
3? It's really challenging to do technical work when you only have 3 fingers. How is he even going to hold like a screwdriver?
Yeah, well, it's basically 2 fingers and a thumb.
I mean, that's fewer fingers than an actual coyote has. Why would they do that to him?
Amy,
he's got like a hard enough life.
Take it up with David Zaslav. This is the exact reason he doesn't want to release that Acme versus Coyote film, because he finds it to be ridiculous, similar to the way that you found Joe Pesci's age to be very ridiculous in Goodfellas. So look, you can both agree.
I maintain that. I maintain.
I know you do.
I maintain that when you have an old person in a mafia movie, it implies that they're good at their job because Old people don't make it in the mafia. They get killed. He's supposed to be a young hothead. You can't get that when it's old Joe Pesci.
Okay, we're not going to go back down that route. But okay, so in one image, I'm looking at a newer image. I definitely see four. But a lot of the older images, I'm seeing three.
He evolved.
He evolved. By the way, thinking about this movie, you know, it's rare that we get these films where it's one person on screen. We've had it in things like Locke, which is that Tom Hardy film where he's alone driving in the car. Great convention to use, like to be in the car and just to, he's not alone in the sense that he's talking to a lot of people on speakerphone. So it's a little different. It's not just him by himself. Then you, of course, have that Ryan Reynolds movie, Buried, where he's trapped in the coffin.
Oh, yeah.
Great movie. But to me, Castaway and The Martian are very similar. And they both have a very similar type of leading actor. Everyone loves Tom Hanks. I think for the most part, most people love Matt Damon.
Wait, you think fewer people love Matt Damon?
I do. I think that sometimes Matt Damon gets himself in trouble. Like, he'll say something and he has to apologize for it. And I like Matt Damon. I think he's great. Really funny, but I feel like he may have a little bit more of I think he might not be as beloved as Tom Hanks. That's my own. I'm reading the tea leaves of social media and I'm going.
I mean, I will say, like, if as a hardcore Laker fan, Matt Damon probably, I'm guessing with his whole Boston stuff, he likes the Celtics. That would be a ding against him.
Well, that's a very specific.
But a lot of people love the Lakers, though. They're America's team. They're the world's team, really.
They are the world's team. And you know what? It's going to be so sad for them not to really enjoy playoffs.
it was nice meeting you the other night, though.
It was great. And you know what? Every year that you guys have beaten us, we haven't gone far in the playoffs. So I hope that this is a trend-setting moment for us. The year that you guys actually beat us, we'll go much further. Because guess what? Beating the Lakers every year, while fun, it didn't do anything for the underlying goal. So that's my hope. That's my hope here.
You know what? I'm just going to say this. Now that we are peeling apart as our teams, you know, now that the Lakers are going down to Inglewood and we are keeping the crypt, now that we are even peeling apart, you know, woe us with you going away for 4 weeks. At least this idea that if you leave us alone on Planet Crypt, the Lakers, we no longer have to remove our banners every time you guys play a game for your own tiny little egos.
That's great. Well, you know what? I honestly think it should be covered up. Why do we need to say that? We have to have some ownership there. And why do Laker fans care what's covered up or what's not covered up? Enjoy your own games. That's like you getting upset about what's going on in an LA Kings game. It doesn't make a difference. Not your thing. Harlem Globetrotters, who cares? Not your thing. Anyway, I think that, you know, when I look at the Castaway movie and I think about this, I feel like Castaway really leaned into the emotional part of being stranded. And I feel like The Martian is almost cold in the way that it views its problems. Like,
it's logical.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that there are amazing moments with Matt Damon where you really are seeing him panicked, right? Seeing him, you know, sad, you know, that moment where he wells up, you know, at the end when he finally hears the voices of his crewmates, which, by the way, he didn't know he was going to hear. They kind of piped that in. His crewmates had already shot their scenes and they piped that in and it connected him because he'd been alone shooting all these scenes by himself and it really did give him something to react to. But I do think that this movie lacks this emotional core that in the rewatch of it, I found it to be slightly less impressive the second time. And I don't mean that in a really, in a bad way. Like, I love watching this movie the first time. It was really fun. I don't know if this is I need to rewatch this.
Oh, that's funny. I understand that feeling and I feel that about a lot of films. But this was a rewatch where I found myself liking The Martian more.
Interesting.
Because when I watched it the first time, I was like, oh, yeah, that was really likable and kind of lightweight, you know? And this time when I watched it, it impressed me even more how much Ridley Scott does not add any of the sappy sentiment of like,
yes,
oh, Jessica Chastain is like his wife or maybe his ex-wife or like the girl that he would have dated if they had ever had a chance to be together in a way that wasn't on a spaceship. You know, when they run into each other's arms or float into each other's arms, collide into each other's arms. It's like emotional for a reason that's like even deeper than the fact that he's being saved. I respect so much that that's not there, that it's not about like love, that like an hour and a half into the movie, Jessica Chastain mentions her boyfriend offhandedly. And you're like, oh, great. I don't even have to wonder about them becoming a couple. You know, I like that he tells her, hey, talk to my parents if I die. But we don't see the parents or see them crying. Like it keeps its eyes focused on the prize, you know, of like survival. And I admire that so much.
I really enjoyed it. And I'm maybe going harder on it just because I'm like, well, what is there to talk about in this movie? It's kind of a tour de force from Matt Damon. It's brilliantly cast with all these very attractive, very diverse people. You know, there's nothing in it. There, the space stuff is very logical. It's real. You've appeased Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's like, it's the most realistic one ever, except apparently Donald Glover's maneuver. No one person would have come up with that. But we're really talking about a movie that did its research.
To be fair, Neil deGrasse Tyson, I think, will say anything for anybody. At any time. I mean, Neil deGrasse Tyson like signed on to do like fake intros pretending all of this was real on the internet as promotion.
Ever since our species first looked up at the sky, we've dreamed of reaching Mars. Back in 2029, that dream became real when the first humans set foot on the red planet. And in a few months, a new group of astronauts will make the journey.
It also, to be fair, Neil deGrasse Tyson played an astrological figure in the new J-Lo movie, which was fantastic, and I loved it. But he also showed up on the red carpet wearing a shirt covered in planets, you know, and talking about it and getting really excited. I mean, Neil deGrasse Tyson, I actually admire how much he likes the camera. Honestly, I feel like the world needs a Neil deGrasse Tyson, a guy who's going to be like, I'm going to talk about science anywhere I can, even if it's in a J-Lo movie. I'm going to do it.
I agree with you 100%. But normally, Neil deGrasse Tyson is the guy who's poo-pooing on what we like. Oh, you can't technically do that. Oh, well, you're not going to do it. And I felt like that was the interesting thing about it. I was like, oh, this is the first time I've really felt this guy going, oh, they kind of got it right. Because I think one of his things that he likes to do is shit on pop culture movies and be like, well, and it's like, buddy, no one's watching these movies for that. Like, let's just let it go.
I mean, he's kind of a troll of science, right?
Yes.
He likes the attention.
I think that Neil deGrasse Tyson wants to be Carl Sagan, but he's coming off a little bit more like Mr. Wizard. And you know what? I'm fine with it.
I loved Mr. Wizard.
I love Mr. Wizard.
I watched Mr. Wizard every day when I was a child. I still think about when Mr. Wizard filled his whole house with like dry ice. That was the coolest thing I ever saw in my life.
Wow. I didn't miss that episode. I love that. I thought that was
really weird. But yeah, I think you're right to say that this movie has more in common with Castaway than pretty much anything, you know, especially in its way of like them coming up with ways to keep this guy who's alone talking, you know, Tom right. Hanks talking to Wilson. And here it's you know, Mark talking to his video recorders, I guess, like recording stuff for posterity back home. And it's a good device because it keeps it kind of moving. It like gives you tons of examples, tons of excuses for Matt Damon just to babble and be talking about things. You know, whenever the people down home are wondering really solemnly, like, oh man, what is Mark Watney thinking? I bet he's really scared. You get this.
You can imagine what he's going through up there. I mean, he's 50 million miles away from home. He thinks he's totally alone. He thinks we gave up on him. I mean, what does that do to a man psychologically? The hell is he thinking right now?
But that scene, I think, really illustrates kind of the crucial difference between, you know, the Mark Watney character and what Tom Hanks is doing in Castaway. Because, yeah, Castaway is more emotional. When Tom Hanks talks to his volleyball, he's being really earnest. Like, he could be himself to this volleyball. I think what we see in The Martian is something closer to a guy consciously performing for a camera. You know, he's talking to an audience. He's not talking to himself. He's trying to put his best foot forward for them, too. And he's trying to be funny. You know, he's trying to be, you know, he's kind of being, honestly, the thing I kept thinking about watching this is I was like, oh, this is science, but done kind of like Richard Hatch on Survivor.
I'm good to go, survival-wise. People-wise, it'll be a little more challenging. But I've got the million-dollar check written already. I mean, I'm the winner. And it's that kind of cocky attitude that makes people really hate your guts. So that's the kind of thing I've really got to keep under wraps.
Amy, what a deep pull. As a Survivor lover, I mean, well, I'm very excited that you pulled that out.
I mean, they're pioneers, right? They're pioneers of presenting themselves maroon.
Colonizers.
For our music.
Colonizers of the island.
Creating a character of who the survivor is, right? I mean, Richard Hatch, I think, is revolutionary in
reality
taking
gaming.
What could have been, reality TV could have actually been a slightly more benign universe. But he was like, what if we had villains and scheming and plotting? And I told you all about it. I mean, great. But like the idea that we could have existed in a world where a reality show was more like science, legitimately scientifically, what is it like when people go to this, you know, to go to Borneo and they have to survive? That is kind of what The Martian is. It's just then Richard Hatch is like, but what if it's really about scheming?
Well, right. I mean, I could get into a whole conversation about Richard Hatch, and I would like to. But now I'm trying to figure out how to keep this on track and say, you're right. I think that there is a performative nature to Mark in this movie that I really like. Because it feels like by going live, even though no one's seeing it, he's got to perform. And so by performing, he muscles through it. He pushes himself harder, right? Because he's trying to, it's not just him alone with his thoughts. It's him performing for a crowd that we don't see. And I think that that's really important because the movie doesn't show us him alone in his thoughts until moments at the end, like right before he leaves, you know, the Hab. You know, those moments where you
see his kind of fear in that, right? Or like his sadness. Yeah. Like there's part of him that's a little crisp. He's like, I'll sign the date. I did it. I'm signing my name. And he's like tidy and kind of, he's not acting like it's bothering him to leave his nest, I guess. But then when he's about to blow off into space and he's scared, you actually get him alone. I feel like you get the real Mark there.
Absolutely. I love those little moments, that we get to see inside of this film. I think this is a great performance. I also think what makes this movie really fantastic and above the rest is there are no villains.
None.
Right? Jeff Daniels could be our villain, but he's not. Right? He is a bureaucrat, but he's also the head of NASA. He's trying to figure out what to do, how to do it. He is the person in charge who has to make the right decisions.
Yeah, because he's not wrong to say that, like, if this goes bad, the public will remember the failure.
Right.
You know, that it has to be about saving NASA as much as one person.
And watching him wrestle with that, I think was really fascinating because I don't think movies like this have nuance. And this movie is all nuance. And maybe if I'm getting to where I've been kind of like rubbing up against it, it's those elements that make this movie so different and so good are also the elements that kind of make it slightly less cinematic. But there are these giant things that are missing. Like the antagonist is the planet, right? Of course, it's fighting against him, but it's not nothing that he can beat. He can just kind of maneuver his way around. He doesn't beat the planet. He just figures out ways to survive on it. I don't know.
It's kind of zen that way or something.
Yes.
Like you can't defeat it. You have to just figure out how to coexist.
I think that this movie is something we don't often see, which is just be smart, appreciate smart people, right? Even Donald Glover's character, which feels at points is kind of amped up for comedy in a way. Donald Glover does an amazing job at laying out this giant piece of exposition that we need to understand about the movie going forward, right? It really is great. And it's one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie because not only do we have Donald Glover acting out this giant technical piece of jargon, but we also have the Lord of the Rings scene. And the Lord of the Rings scene to me is like the perfect example of like where comedy is in this. So, you know, this is a movie where, you know, we're just watching everybody like kind of goof on Lord of the Rings. And we get Sean Bean, who's in Lord of the Rings. I'm like, yes, this is what I want. We get to see like Boromir kind of joking around. Like I loved it. I love that scene.
And it's funny, right? Because it reminds me that this was a moment where when I looked around at the landscape, it felt like we were never going to escape nerd culture as well. Do you know? Like, yeah. I love the nerdiness about this. I love the nerdiness about this. But I remember being a film critic at this time, because I was, trust me, when like the apocalypse happens or I'm ever stranded on Mars, it will never work for me to say, luckily, I'm a film critic. You know, it doesn't matter. Won't help me with anything. But I remember at this moment spending so much of my time reading deep histories of like comic book characters and stuff just to be able to do my job, you know, because it felt like
you're doing it better than anybody else then.
But this took me back to that moment, you know, of like, yeah, yeah. Like nerds really ran the world for a while. And now it's like jocks, bro. No, I don't know who runs the world anymore, but like not nerds in the same way.
It wasn't just like nerds, you know. Yeah. Benedict Wong is fantastic. I was shocked at the end of the movie. I was like, wait, that's Benedict Wong? I didn't even see it. And
he's so funny. And you get his character too, just being like, ugh, okay, this sucks. I'll stay here and shower.
And he, you know, he's really playing the Scotty from Star Trek role. So I think there's something really triumphant about watching smart people do their jobs well, right? That's what these notes that you always get when you're developing scripts or characters, like, I want to see them be good at their job. Well, this is a movie full of people good at their job. There are these saves, like, or not even saves, like when that, the supply ship blows up, like it was because they rushed, but they didn't rush for the wrong reason. Like you would have done it too.
Yeah, like being smart doesn't mean they don't screw up, you know?
Yeah.
Like this movie, I think, draws kind of a fine line between being hardworking and being optimistic and being a badass who can do everything. And I feel like so many movies are about badasses, and this is a different shade. You know, it's about the work.
And what I also love about this movie is it's not easy. There's no one who pulls up a computer program and shows you, well, we do X, Y, and Z. Like even this, the fix at the end of the film, removing the 5,000 kilograms, which is like roughly like 1,000 pounds of weight from this MAV.
Oh, thank you for translating that. I grew up in America and I don't know the metric system.
No, neither did I. I mean, I'm looking at a note right in front of me. You know, there's this kind of... Yeah, we don't know. We think this is right. We hope it's right. There's no camera that can zoom in on him perfectly. They're watching him move around. They're seeing things. There's a delay. We never get that video. You think, oh, at one point, they're going to just be able to talk back and forth. No, it's like a 30-minute delay. And I love that back and forth where they're both kind of falling asleep waiting for the response. Like, this is a movie that I think is about celebrating ingenuity and perseverance and looking at it outside of the role of Mars. It's extremely relatable. And maybe that's the reason why people love this movie, because I think, yes, when we watch movies, we put ourselves as the main characters often or not. But I think here, because of everything you said, he's not a superhuman. He is just someone who has some knowledge about plants. That gets him to one place. Then everybody else. But it's also a movie where help isn't frowned upon. And I think in an action movie, there's always a lead character. And it's like, God damn it, I know the right way to do this. I've been watching Bosch. This is now me talking Paul Scheer. I've been watching Bosch nonstop. I love him, Bosch. And, you know, Bosch is going to go his own way. He knows what he's got to do to get the job done. He's going to listen to other people? Probably not. Maybe every now and then, but not that much. And I think this is a movie where... it's nice. We're celebrating that everyone has a purpose. Everyone is smart. Everyone should be listened to. And I wonder if that makes for a slightly less interesting film on rewatchability.
I mean, I wonder, to me, that's exactly the element that I found inspirational. I mean, maybe part of this is I'm rewatching The Martian now after pandemic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like, what I was thinking about the whole time he was learning to grow potatoes, and you know, hey, I got Irish DNA. I really value potatoes. That's great. I've been eating a lot more potatoes. I got scared of potatoes. I thought, oh, they don't have nutritional value. I don't know. I feel like I got lied to by like big quinoa or something. Potatoes are great. But it made me think when he was growing potatoes, I felt connected to that scene now more than I did then, because it reminded me of when I learned during pandemic that if you take the bulbs of green onions and put them in a glass of water, you can regrow green onions. And that meant so much to me during pandemic because I love green onions. And to this day, I still continue to grow green onions in my window because, like, to learn that you can cut a green onion and it comes back, like, oh my God, you know? And now I felt a little bit like Mark Watney when that happened. And it's a lesson I carry with me to this day. And so I think those scenes, I don't know, they hit me a lot harder. They hit me a lot harder. But I hear exactly what you're saying about the lack of villain here. Like, part of me had remembered this movie a little wrong. It had remembered it as like the, oh man, Kristen Wiig's just the absolute worst. You know, it had kind of right. put her in the villain slot, you know, starting from kind of her real concern about like, well, how are we going to handle the fact that he's not dead? We're NASA. We're dealing with billions of dollars and the public goodwill. And I think there are some moments where the movie almost gets maybe a little bit too close of getting hard on her character, the way like Jeff Daniels, you know, clicks a pen on her forehead like she's just some sort of dummy. You know, like literally the dummy of the room is how he's treating right. her. But she gets to also just be happy that he makes it home. And that means something to me that she's like, oh, good. And, you know, she keeps her job. We see her post the credits. She's still a good PR person. And in a way, she's doing what a PR person is just supposed to do. You know, she's got to protect the ship. She's got to protect NASA. She's got to think of it from like a distanced kind of inhuman way, honestly. Because it's right. It is about more than him in her POV. And I think that's a POV that I can also agree with in a way. I can see the strength of that POV. Part of me rebels against, like, should we be spending that much money to get this one guy back when we could be doing other stuff?
Right. And maybe that's the interesting conflict, right? This idea that there isn't really any right answer. Like, Jeff Daniels could have made either choice. I mean, one would have been a much more depressing film. But, you know,
we just,
like,
watch him starve to death.
And at any point, he could have died. I mean, that's the other thing, too. Like, that's the other part of this movie. It's like, there's no guarantee that he would have been there for a long time, right? So it's, you're putting all this resource, all this money to this thing. And that's why, like, when China's like, well, should we do this? It's like, you know, I think this is a movie that celebrates humanity. This is a movie that celebrates exploration and science and really unity. And that's important. And I think it really tries very hard to take away these things that could be seen as overly dramatic. Like in the book, which I read and is great, there's an accident that doesn't allow Mark Watney to talk to anybody while he does that trek across Mars. So that whole last section, he is cut off from communication. There's like this accident that happens, if I'm remembering that correctly. And that's a dramatic thing. He's got to do it all by himself. But this, it kind of makes it easier. Though he's still in communication. He's still learning. He's doing his thing. You know, they add some dramatic tension about like how he can board the ship. And I think they add, you know, the bomb thing is really great. I love that moment where they're like, what's our damage? Like, let's worry about that later. Let's save him first.
Wait, is it true that in the book they make more of a deal about how much Vicodin he's taking? Because here there's like that tiny joker who's putting Vicodin on a potato, like that's better than ketchup, or it's not better than ketchup, but at least is a version of ketchup, which sounds awful. I'm imagining it just tasting really bitter.
No, yeah, you should be using fentanyl actually on the potatoes.
Oh, it
tastes way better.
Yeah.
No, yeah, the book has all those kind of like fun moments. I mean, look, I'm personally upset they cut out one of my favorite jokes from the book about Aquaman. Like there's one moment where you talked about, you know, when they check in with him, he's like, he realizes that Aquaman shouldn't be able to speak to like whales because they're mammals. He's like, wait, that's not right. It shouldn't work like that. Because Aquaman, I think, speaks to fish. He can't speak to mammals, though.
Oh, I mean, definitely not on Earth. Unless he's had a couple brewskis, he gets his confidence up.
Oh, my gosh. But, you know, the thing is, the reason why he's a pirate, I think, at the end, again, this is me reading this book a long time ago, is because he is isolated and alone. That whole twist at the end, that idea that he's a pirate sailing the seas without knowing what's going on in front of him is because he has no communication. He's out of reach of everybody. You know, he's alone.
Oh, I thought it might also be because it looks like he has scurvy. And also, I mean, that part of Mars was like an ancient ocean, they think, most likely, an ancient ocean. But maybe just scurvy. I mean, his whole back is all sore and scurvy-ish, right?
It's so rough.
Because I love that joke, though, about like the, how is he feeling? No, wait, how is he feeling?
How's he doing?
So far, so good. He's sticking to schedule.
How's he doing?
He asked us to call him Captain Blondebeard.
Well, technically Mars would be under maritime.
Yeah, no, I know. He explained it to us.
You know, I actually had a question even about like the musical selection in this part because I'm not going to hate on any of the ABBA, any of the disco. I love all of this kind of music. But knowing that, like, you know, 8 years after Ridley Scott makes this movie, he's going to make Napoleon, I just cannot believe that he already used the music cue here. I mean, don't you think he just should have saved that? I think I would have liked Napoleon a lot better if he figured out one excuse to play Waterloo.
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, I think the movie does. I wish they would have continued with disco the entire time. I was a little bummed out when they go to David Bowie. As much as I love David Bowie, it's like, yeah.
It's overdone for space.
Yeah. I also felt like we committed to this one thing. And why change it? It's funny. It would have been funny to have that dramatic moment there. You know, By the way, I will survive.
They could have done it. I mean, but it is that smash up of like near death, beautiful shots, but also disco that makes me. It's kind of the only thing that makes me admit watching this movie that yes, Ridley Scott is capable of doing both Alien and House of Gucci. You know, like that's the most House of Gucci thing in this movie.
Look, if he would have had an Italian accent, I would have loved this movie even more. I think maybe. What trumps everything about this movie is watching one person. And yes, we go away from Mark Watney for a long time, but we really are with this character that we can all see ourselves as because we want to be seen as the smartest. Or we want to be seen as the most rational. I think it's really interesting that Andrew Weir's follow-up book that Lord and Miller are going to make into a feature film with Ryan Gosling is once again about a lone astronaut. It's about an astronaut who wakes up to find himself millions of miles away from home with no memory of who he is. His crewmates are dead. And then he finds out that he's humanity's only hope for survival. And he's got a kind of, it's like a reverse mystery.
I mean, doesn't it feel like we just keep putting the same actors in space over and over again?
Ryan Gosling has been in space a few times.
He's been in space a lot. Matt Damon's been in space a lot. Like Matt Damon had done Interstellar right before this, where he's like also playing a marooned astronaut on an island, except he, in that case, he would kill people to stay alive.
I tried to do my duty, Cooper, but I knew the day that I arrived here, this place had nothing. And I resisted the temptation for years. But I knew that if I just pressed that button, then somebody would come and save me.
Hey, fucking coward.
Oh, yeah. Right. My gosh.
Right?
And like, Chastain was in that too, wasn't she?
Yeah, she's also in that. We just keep sending the same people to outer space. It's weird. Like, George Clooney has been in space a couple times, right? He does Gravity. He does Solaris. There's, like, a kind of space actor. They're like, yeah, send me to space. Send me to space. I mean, and there's, like, I guess our space directors too. I think it's really funny that, you know, Christopher Nolan went to NASA and he was like, hey, can we play Interstellar for the guys in space? I think they'd really like it. I think that'd also be great promotion. Please, NASA, let us beam Interstellar up to space. And NASA was like, nah. But then Ridley Scott is like, can I put the Martian in space? Can we beam the Martian up to space? And they're like, yeah, totally. Go ahead. I mean, wow. Can you imagine how Nolan felt? I would actually love to know how Nolan felt. Like, do you think he was, how mad do you think Nolan was that NASA gave that to Ridley Scott?
Well, because I think that one is pro NASA. I don't think Interstellar is pro NASA. I mean, this is a very pro NASA movie. But I wanted to ask you this question about space. Like, why do we like a space movie? I know we like a plane movie. Why do we like that? At least June likes a plane movie. I like movies on planes, not like watching them on planes, but movies that take place on planes. It's this interesting thing. Like what attracts us? Like, why is it from 2001 to now, or Star Trek, Star Wars, like what is it about space that feels engaging? Is it just because there's so much out there that we don't know? There's a vastness. There's a, like, in a world in which we can access everything, that's a place where we can't access anything.
Yeah, I mean, it is so much about like self-reliance. It's like it's like being a human being walking through the world, but with the exponential challenge of if you make one tiny mistake going about your ordinary day, you could die. You know, is there something just evocative about thinking, what will it be like when we can only rely on ourselves? Because I guess there's two types of space movies, right? You know, there's, right. Hey, we're off in space and that's a normal thing. We're fucking around, Guardians of the Galaxy, la-da-da-da-da. I love music. We're chilling out. Hey, these are all our cool space friends. But then there's the other space movie, which this one is, you know, what is it when I'm in space and it's just me and science and the humans around me? In that kind of pared down naturalistic space movie. You know, the one that I love, if people are into movies like The Martian, is a Swedish movie called Aniara. That's about, you know, a giant rocket full of people that goes off course. And that is very much about how, about like a extreme example of what humans can be and do to each other, like what we need to survive.
Right.
Because is it drilling into that thing that he talks about in the closing, which just makes you think that yes, we are all on a planet hurtling into the space, and like, and what do we do here? That what would we do in these idealized movie versions that makes us think about how we live here?
Well, but I also think what you're saying is space is one of those rare places where we get to be alone with the human mind. This kind of battle, this blank slate to play out who you are in a life and death situation, I think is incredibly engaging. No one will know. Who are you when the chips are down? Like these moments. I also, by the way, we're talking about solo movies in space. We have to mention Moon, the Duncan Jones film, which is also, I love that film as well. But like this idea that you're wrestling with, who am I?
Yeah. And at the same time, you can't be the person that much different than who you innately are.
But it does also show you who you are versus who you think you are.
Right. I mean, and that is why I think what makes The Martian work is because it's both about who he is in terms of a survivor and a scientist and like a resolute human being who can tap into some kind of motivation that's like what I would aspire to be, but I don't think I have, you know, because of course, as I've said, like when the zombie apocalypse happens, I just want to die day one because I don't see any point in pretending I could survive that. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
But like he has all of that humanity in him that I look up to, but then he also just curses left and right. And makes really dumb jokes. And I think the fusion of those two make Mark Watney great, you know, that he is both the best version of who we could be, but also doesn't feel that different from us in the way he talks. When they have to remind him not to swear so much on like the NASA hotline, that's going to be recorded in history for posterity.
Yeah.
It's going to be like the PR nightmare image of what NASA scientists are like. And by the way, do you want to hear one of the funniest actual NASA posterity things that I have ever heard that is recorded? It's from Apollo 16 in the 1970s.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, because this exists. You can find it on YouTube.
I got the parts again. I got them again, Charlie. I don't know what gives them to me. I think it's acid stone. I really do. I haven't eaten this much citrus fruit in 20 years. And I'll tell you one thing, in another 12 days, I ain't never eating anymore.
Oh, God. All I want to do is say a horrible tagline, like in space, no one can smell your fart. But I don't even want to say it. I had to do it.
That's it.
Once it was in my brain, it had to come out.
That's our poll quote. We're going to make a social media video.
No.
Amy Nicholson, New York Times reviewer.
No.
In space, no one can smell your fart. But... look, for all my bitching and moaning about this movie, and it's really just me trying to find a flaw in it, because I think when I enjoy a movie like this, I don't want to just look at things and just accept it as being great. I want to look at it and go like, oh, what challenges me about it? This is a movie that when I put it on last night, I saw the runtime and I was like, oh, God damn it, 2.5 hours? Because it made it, or I remembered it being quick. I was like, I think this is a short one. I think it's like 90 minutes.
Ugh, we need 90 minutes on the show, man.
Oh, we love a 90 minute. But it flew by. So I guess what I'm saying is I am missing it because you're telling me I'm missing it. It's like an impossible burger. It tastes like a burger and it looks like a burger and it goes down like a burger, but it's not a burger. I'm like, well, maybe it's missing some burger stuff. I'm like, but did you enjoy it? Yeah, I did. Tastes like a burger? Yeah, I did. But it doesn't feel, is it really a burger? No. I don't know then. Is it a burger? That's me in this entire conversation. And it went down quick. It was fun to watch. The characters are great. The casting is really good. They really pull off this ending, which is probably the most action-packed sequence. You know, in a movie where the CGI is not taking really front and center of anything. You know, they come up with this interesting idea, and it's something so scary about him shooting up like Iron Man like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I also loved about it was you could get that close and be so far. Like, it's like, well, I'll wave to you as I fly by. Like, there is nothing else to do, you know, and you had to make a choice, and he made a choice. And I think throughout this entire film, he is okay with dying. And that gives him a tremendous amount of freedom. I don't think he's trying to die, but he could have killed himself with the fire. He could have killed himself outside of that ship. He could have killed himself by drop, you know, the way that, who knows?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to scare you, but we could kill ourselves at any point today.
You know, believe me, I think
I gotta
about
go drive across town at rush hour to go see Kung Fu Panda 4. Am I gonna die going to go see
Worth
Kung Fu
it.
Panda 4?
Worth it. But I don't know if it's my favorite person alone in a scenario, but it's a movie that you can't yell back at the screen at. It's a movie that I think makes you feel like you accomplished something at the end of it. If we're talking about what I'd rather have, like if it was Spotlight or this, I want this. You know, we just got off of our whole Oscar run. And this, to me, has more legs than that. It's more interesting than that.
But are you, I mean, do you prefer Castaway? Like,
no.
Do you want
no,
to do Castaway?
Castaway is too schmaltzy for me.
I mean, I appreciate if you want to be the Goldilocks of schmaltz, because I feel also very sensitive to schmaltz.
Well, wait. So if we're the Goldilocks of schmaltz, are we saying that this one has too much, this one has, yeah, I think we're trying to find the right amount of schmaltz. And maybe this movie does have the right amount of schmaltz. I mean, one of the jokes in the book is like, if this was made into a Hollywood movie, all the astronauts would high five at the end. And they actually do that in the movie. I think that that's like a meta tip of the hat.
Wow, that's like an American Fiction joke.
Yeah, it really is. And I love that we get to see him at the end. Like, he looks a little worse for wear. Don't you feel like he does?
I do. I mean, they did actually cut like one thing from the end of this movie, which is, you know, as he's on the spaceship, looking out the window, headed towards Earth, you know, knowing he's coming home, he starts this kind of narration that leads over the part of him sitting on the bench where he sees all the kids run by, you know, mm-hmm. and it's like day one. There is a narration that kind of engages with some of the stuff we're talking about here about financially even. Was it worth it? Why did all of this movie have to happen in the first place?
I think about the sheer number of people who pulled together to save my sorry ass, and I can barely comprehend it. The cost of my survival was in the hundreds of millions of dollars, all to save a botanist with anti-authority issues. Why bother? Sure, part of it might be what I represent. Progress. Science. The interplanetary future we've dreamed about for centuries. But really, they saved me because that's what we do. Every human being has a basic instinct to help each other out. If a hiker gets lost in the mountains, people coordinate a search. If an earthquake levels the city, people all over the world send emergency supplies. This instinct is found in every culture without exception. And because of it, I had an entire planet on my side.
And you know, I think that would have made it too schmaltzy for me. Because right. I want to believe in what this movie says there, that we humans will always help each other. You know, it's like the thing that Mr. Rogers said, you know, when there's in times of like disaster, look for the helpers, look for the people who are running in to help. I really do deeply think that's more true than not. But I don't know if I think it's as true as this movie thinks it is true. I wish it was. I wish I was less cynical. I wish, maybe I'm wrong. I would love nothing more than to be wrong. That part of me that is too cynical hears that line and thinks, yeah, I'm glad you cut that. That would have been too much.
But maybe the reason why this movie is so good is because, once again, it breaks the trap that they all have, which is he's not alone. He goes off screen for a long period of time in this movie. And we get all these other characters. And even though they're not working together, they kind of are. You know, they are a team. And so it allows you, I think, to not get sick of anything. It becomes fun. You know, there is something about it where they get to make a one-person movie, but also make a movie with a lot of other people, too.
Yeah, with that gigantic cast. I mean, it makes me at least happy that that cast is probably what helped push this movie into being, you know, the 10th biggest hit of the year financially. I appreciate a movie like this being a blockbuster, especially as I do steel myself to go see Kung Fu Panda 4.
Well, Amy, I hope you enjoy Kung Fu Panda 4. So I guess, you know what I'm saying, Amy? I loved it. I love this movie. I'm on board. And, you know, to salute this movie, give it its proper tip of the hat, I think maybe a fun throwback episode that we can put back out there that you can kind of listen to is Lord of the Rings. Get to see Sean Bean in his greatness in that film. What if, to keep this conversation going, we talk about a man stranded on the moon?
I love it. I love it. I have not seen the moon since it came out. And I'm really intrigued. And I will say this. If The Moon, which is, of course, directed by Duncan Jones, does play David Bowie, I will forgive it. I don't remember if it does. I don't remember if it does. And I do feel like Starman is so overdone. But if anybody gets to, it is David Bowie's son.
Well, let's do it. I'm excited to kind of compare and contrast, kind of see like who makes the best hot dog here. Because I think they're very similar, but they're very different.
Oh, I'm really hungry. I should get a hot dog at Kung Fu Panda.
You should. I was going to say, it's a perfect movie to eat a hot dog with. Our show could not be done without our team. And a huge thank you goes to them each and every week. Produced and edited by Cody Fisher and our associate producer, Jessica Cisneros. Our engineer is Casey Holford and our MVP is Molly Reynolds. Our theme song is by Michael Cassidy and our fan art is by Kim Troxell. Check it out all on social media. And you can find us on social media at Unspooled on Twitter and Instagram. And you can join in the conversation about all things Unspooled on the Paul Scheer Discord at discord.gg/Paul Scheer. There's an entire Unspooled section. T-shirts, mugs, stickers, and all Unspooled merch are available at tpublic.com/unspooled. And you can get a deck of Unspooled playing cards and more merch at podswag.com. That's right. And if you can't get enough Unspooled, you can listen to our archive for free anywhere you get your podcast. But remember to rate and review us. It does help. And finally, you can always check out the API list. That's right, the ever-growing list that we will eventually shoot into space at unspooled.com. And just a reminder, my book, Joyful Recollections of Trauma, comes out May 21st. You can pre-order it now, and if you do, I'll be so thankful. See you next time. Bye for now.
Hi there, this is Mary Holland. You may know me from Happiest Season, or Veep, or The Woman in the House Across the Street from the Girl in the Window. Or you may know me as Janice Cramps. Huh? I want to wish Comedy Bang Bang a happy 15th anniversary. Wow, 15 years old. Comedy Bang Bang is about to get its driver's permit. I'm so excited for it. And I'm, you know, really grateful because Comedy Bang Bang has brought me so much joy as a listener and a performer. And I'm just very grateful for this community that we have in Comedy Bang Bang. You can hear me and a lot of other very funny people on Comedy Bang Bang wherever you get your podcasts. So what are you waiting for? Tune in.